and a rubber plantation. Mobutu's habit of printing more money when he needed it resembled nothing so much as Leopold's printing of Congo bonds. "Those who are conquered," wrote the philosopher Ibn Khaldun in the 14th century, "always want to imitate the conqueror in his main characteristics, in his clothing, his crafts, and in all his distinctive traits and customs." Mobutu's luxurious Villa del Mare, a pink and white marble colonnaded chateau at Roquebrune-Cap-Martin on the French Riviera, complete with indoor and outdoor swimming pools, gold-fitted bathrooms and heliport, lay a mere dozen miles down the coast from the estates Leopold once owned at Cap Ferrat. From one cape you can see the other. What epitaph can we write for the movement that worked so hard for justice in the Congo 100 years ago? The Congo reform movement had two achievements that lasted far beyond its own time. First, through the efforts of E.D. Morel, Roger Casement, and equally brave but lesser-known figures like George Washington Williams, William Shepherd, and Hezekiah Andrew Shanu, it put a remarkable amount of information on the historical record. And there it remains, despite the strenuous efforts of Leopold and his admirers, then and now, to burn it, to ignore it, to distort it with mythologizing. That record of truth matters, especially for a continent whose history is otherwise so filled with silences. The movement's other great achievement is this. Among its supporters, it kept alive a tradition, a way of seeing the world, a human capacity for outrage at pain inflicted on another human being, no matter whether that pain is inflicted on someone of another color, in another country, at another end of the earth. When the Congo reformers spoke at hundreds of mass meetings throughout Britain and the United States, they showed slides, photographs of adults and children with their hands cut off, forced laborers at work as porters, a devastated village. "Lantern lecture on the Congo atrocities," read an advertisement. 60 excellent photographic lantern slides from photographs taken by Mrs. Harrit, late of Baringa, Congo Free State. Descriptive lecture, revised by the Reverend J. H. Harris and Mr. E. D. Morel. These slides were black and white, approximately 3 inches square, made for magic lantern projectors. Someone who goes in search of those slides today can find them. They rest in 2 dusty wooden boxes on a storage shelf on the ground floor of a small, low-rent building in South London. The building is the office of Anti-Slavery International, formerly the Anti-Slavery Society, formerly the Anti-Slavery and Aborigines Protection Society, formerly the British and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society. John and Alice Harris ran the society for many years after their work with Morel. In continuous existence since 1839, it is the oldest human rights organization on earth. Today, in that room with the boxes of slides, men and women in their 20s briskly come and go, carrying posters, video cassettes, and bundles of pamphlets about child labor in Bangladesh and Nepal and Malaysia, women in household slavery in the Middle East, debt bondage in Brazil, child prostitution in Thailand, genital mutilation of women in Africa, the exploitation of immigrant domestic servants in England. The tradition that is alive in that London office has grown and broadened in the last 200 years. Today we are less likely to speak of humanitarianism, with its overtones of paternalistic generosity, and more likely to speak of human rights. The basic freedoms in life are not seen as gifts to be doled out by benevolent well-wishers, but, as Casement said at his trial, as those rights to which all human beings are entitled from birth. It is this spirit which underlies organizations like Amnesty International, with its belief that putting someone in prison solely for his or her opinions is a crime, whether it happens in China or Turkey or Argentina, and Médecins Sans Frontières, with its belief that a sick child is entitled to medical care, whether in Rwanda or Honduras or the South Bronx. The Congo reform movement, at its best, not only helped to shape and strengthen this set of beliefs, it went beyond them. Human rights groups today usually deal with results: a man in jail, a woman in servitude, a child without medicine. E.D. Morel talked, as well, about causes, above all, the theft of African land and labor that made possible Leopold's whole system of exploitation. It was this radicalism, in the best and deepest sense of the word, that underlay the passion of the leading Congo reformers, and that led Morel and Casement, after their battle for justice in the Congo, to Pentonville Prison. The larger tradition of which they are a part goes back to the French Revolution and beyond. It draws on the example of men and women who fought against enormous odds for their freedom, from the slave revolts of the Americas to the half-century of resistance that brought Nelson Mandela to power in South Africa. During its decade on the world stage, the Congo reform movement was a vital link in that chain, and there is no tradition more honourable. At the time of the Congo controversy 100 years ago, the idea of full human rights, political, social, and economic, was a profound threat to the established order of most countries on earth. It still is today. Acknowledgements. My thanks go to staff members at the Royal Geographical Society in London, Anti-Slavery International in London, the Musée Royal de l'Afrique Centrale in Tervuren, Belgium, the Musée Royal de l'Armée et d'Histoire Militaire in Brussels, Svenska Missionsförbundet in Stockholm, the American Baptist Historical Society in Rochester, New York, and the Department of History of the Presbyterian Church, USA, in Montreat, North Carolina, all of whom kindly responded to my requests for information, photographs, or other materials. Thanks also to Enid Schildkraut at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, to the archivists at Hampton University, Hampton, Virginia, who allowed me to look at William Shepherd's papers, to Ebba Segerberg for translations from the Swedish, and to David Raymond and Fritz Stern for some good bibliographic suggestions. Writing this book helped me understand the essential role of libraries in preserving the records of history that powerful interests want forgotten or that people have chosen to ignore. I felt grateful to be able to borrow a book, even though, as I found in one case, I was the first person who had checked it out since 1937. I felt grateful to be able to borrow a book, even though, as I found in one case, I was the first person who had checked it out since 1937. Or, and this happened to me twice, to check out a library book from decades ago and find the pages still uncut. My thanks to the many helpful staff members at the various places I did research, the libraries at Northwestern University, Yale University, and Bates College, the New York Public Library, the Library of Union Theological Seminary in New York, the Hoover and Green Libraries at Stanford University, and, above all, the Doe, Moffitt, and Bancroft Libraries of the University of California at Berkeley, where I did most of my work. Berkeley's rich range of materials from a century ago is eloquent testimony to what existed before small-minded politicians and tax-cutting fanatics began slashing the budgets of American public and state university libraries. Although she was in the midst of finishing a remarkable book of her own, my wife, Arlie, talked, lived, and breathed this project with me every step of the way. By the time the manuscript was ready for her insightful reading, she knew the characters in the Congo story almost as if they were close friends of ours. I was lucky to have many real-life friends who also read the manuscript and gave me helpful comments, often drawing on their experience as writers, journalists, or historians. Ai Kwe Arma, Harriet Barlow, Mary Felstiner, Laurie Flynn, David Hochschild, Patricia LaBalm, Paul Solman, Alan Wheelis, Francis Wilson, and Blakey, Monty, and Robert F. Worth. For critical readings and other support, I am also grateful to my agents, Denise Shannon and Georges Borchardt, and to my former editor at Houghton Mifflin, Dawn Safarian. Almost every page of this book benefited immeasurably from intensive editorial consulting from Tom Engelhardt. Among American writers who care about their craft, Tom's name is a well-kept secret. There are few people alive for whom the act of critically reading, untangling and polishing a sentence, a paragraph, an entire book, is so much an act of the highest craftsmanship. If there were Oscars for editing, Tom would have won his long ago. As a newcomer to this tragic patch of history, I was helped in my explorations by several people who know far more about it than I. Daniel van Groenwegen read the manuscript and shared some documents with me. And I owe a special debt of gratitude to the two greatest scholars of this period, the anthropologist Jan Vansinner and the historian Jules Marchal. Both generously responded to numerous calls and letters asking for information, and both read the manuscript with painstaking care, Marchal in two successive drafts, saving me from innumerable errors. They are not responsible for any mistakes that crept in by accident in my subsequent rewriting, or for the few points where my interpretation may differ from that of one or the other of them. I cannot thank them enough. This concludes the reading of King Leopold's Ghost by Adam Hochschild. This book was read by Jeffrey Howard. If you have enjoyed these tapes, you may want to consider buying this audiobook and donating it to your local library, so that others in your community can enjoy it too. The donation will be deductible to the extent allowable under the law. Books on Tape produces many new unabridged audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, or to arrange a library donation, or to speed your next title to you without delay, call our customer service department.
We hope you enjoyed this reading. Please continue listening to sample another Books on Tape bestseller.
Explaining Hitler: The Search for the Origins of His Evil, by Ron Rosenbaum. Part 1. Copyright 1998 by Ron Rosenbaum. This recording of the full-length reading of Explaining Hitler was published by arrangement with the author and was produced in 1999 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book is read by Barrett Whitener. Explaining Hitler, by Ron Rosenbaum. This book consists of 20 chapters and is 395 pages long. Part 1 consists of chapters 1 through 10. To those who survived, and to those who did not. The more I learn about Hitler, the harder I find it to explain. Alan Bullock. There will never be an adequate explanation. The closer one gets to explicability, the more one realizes nothing can make Hitler explicable. Emil Fockenheim. Hitler is explicable in principle, but that does not mean that he has been explained. Yehuda Bauer. He, God, owes me answers to many questions. Holocaust Survivor at Auschwitz, 1985. Introduction. The Baby Pictures and the Abyss. In the realm of Hitler explanations, it's come to be called the survival myth, and though no one believes it now, it struck a chord in the post-war popular imagination. The image of a Hitler who had escaped the Berlin bunker, escaped the flames that were said to have consumed him, escaped judgment, turned out to be a curiously seductive one, inspiring fantasists from the lowbrow, the legendary Police Gazette, Hitler Alive in Argentina series, to the highly cerebral, George Steiner's challenging parable, The Portage to San Cristobal of A.H. Seductive, perhaps, because it reflects a feeling that, although Hitler did not escape us physically, in certain important respects he may have eluded us. The survival myth suggests a persistent anxiety that Hitler has somehow escaped explanation. Similarly suggestive is the debate that erupted in 1995 over the discovery of a few curved shards of bone reposing in a Moscow archive, said to be the surviving remains of Hitler's cranium. The controversy over the identity of the skull fragments, an important one because they could perhaps tell us something about the circumstances of Hitler's suicide, his final act of self-definition, may be a symptom of a more disturbing truth. Regardless of what became of his skull, a sure sense of Hitler's mind has escaped us. The real search for Hitler, the search for who he was, who he thought he was, and why he did what he did, has been an expedition into a realm far more inaccessible than the rainforest jungles of Argentina or the remote haciendas of Paraguay, supposed hideouts of the escaped Hitler in the survival myth. It's not a search for where Hitler has hidden, but for what he hid within him. It's a trek into the trackless realm of Hitler's inwardness, a realm disguised by his own deceitfulness, camouflaged by thickets of conflicting evidence, a tangled undergrowth of unreliable memory and testimony, of misleading rumor, myth, and biographical apocrypha. A terra incognita of ambiguity and incertitude, where armies of scholars clash in evidentiary darkness over the spectral shadows of Hitler's past and the maddening obscurities of his psyche. Is it conceivable, more than half a century after Hitler's death, after all that's been written and said, that we're still wandering in this trackless wilderness, this garden of forking paths, with no sight of the quarry? Or rather, alas, with too many quarries, The search for Hitler has apprehended not one coherent consensus image of Hitler, but rather many different Hitlers, competing Hitlers, conflicting embodiments of competing visions. Hitlers who might not recognize each other well enough to say Heil if they came face to face in hell. The mountebank Hitler of Alan Bullock's initial vision might well not see himself in the possessed true believer, the mesmeric occult messiah of H.R. Trevor Roper. Nor would the contemptuously laughing Hitler, Lucy Davidovich lived in the 70s, find much in common with the dithering, hesitant Hamlet Hitler of Christopher Browning, the state-of-the-art Hitler of the 90s. Yes, an enormous amount has been written, but little has been settled. And certain things have been lost and forgotten. Just to touch upon that which has not been settled, there is the question of the origin of Hitler's anti-Semitism, the degree of its sincerity. Was he a true believer, as H.R. Trevor Roper has always insisted, or a cynical opportunist who merely manipulated hatred of Jews for his own advancement, as Alan Bullock and the theologian Emil Falkenhayn have argued? There are unsettled issues about such basic questions as Hitler's ancestry. Did he fear he was infected by Jewish blood? His sexuality? Its relation, if any, to his political pathology? And the moment of his death? Did he die a soldier's death, shooting himself with his own hand? Or was it a coward's death, a kind of assisted suicide with the help of cyanide and a valet, as a controversial Russian autopsy report argued? If his end is in doubt, so is the question of his advent and his success. Was it inevitable or resistible? Were Hitler's crimes the consequence of irresistible historical forces or an implacable personal will? At the heart of these questions is the elusive, perhaps unfathomable, object of the search for Hitler— the nature of Hitler's thought world. Was he convinced of his own rectitude, as Trevor Roper firmly insists? Did he believe in some deeply deluded way that he was doing good? Or was he deeply aware of his own criminality, as the philosopher Beryl Lang has gone to great lengths to establish? Beneath this vexed question is the even more vexatious debate over Hitlerian exceptionalism. Is Hitler on a continuum with previous and successive mass murderers, explicable within the same framework, on the extreme end of the same spectrum of the human nature we supposedly share with Jeffrey Dahmer and Mahatma Gandhi? Is there a potential Hitler within all of us, as some like to say? Or is he off the grid, beyond the continuum in a category of his own, as Emil Falkenhayn, who rejects the Hitler within notion, argues? Then there is the question of Hitler's precise role and his degree of personal responsibility for the Holocaust. Powerful tendencies in contemporary scholarship have cumulatively served to diminish the decisiveness and centrality of Hitler's role. There is, first, the predisposition to look upon Hitler as the pawn of larger, purportedly deeper and more profound forces of history and society, forces that made the Holocaust inevitable with or without Hitler's agency. It's a predisposition expressed by the President of the United States when at the dedication of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial, Bill Clinton spoke of the way the German culture, which produced Goethe, Schiller, and Beethoven, then brought forth Hitler and Himmler. Hitler as cultural product rather than immoral agent. And there is a concomitant tendency to regard anything that hints of a great man theory of history as unsophisticated compared with the resort to explanation by great abstractions such as Western racism, eliminationist anti-Semitism, or even, still, dialectical materialism. The great abstraction theorists are certain that if it hadn't been Hitler, given the historical circumstances of Germany, such forces would have produced someone like Hitler to execute the final solution. It's a view that tends to deprecate or make relatively irrelevant the motive and psychology of the Hitler we did get. It's a tendency heatedly disputed by, among others, the influential polemicist Milton Himmelfarb, who took arms against great abstraction theories in a powerful 1984 essay entitled No Hitler, No Holocaust. Himmelfarb's particular target in that essay was the theory that singles out Christian anti-Semitism as the true source of the Holocaust. Himmelfarb argues that abstract ideological or theological animus is not sufficient. All that history of Christian persecution of the Jews could have been the same, and Hitler could as easily, more easily, not have murdered the Jews. He could more advantageously have tightened the screws of oppression, as anti-Semitic tyrants had done in the past, without pushing for and nearly achieving utter extermination. That decision was Hitler's alone, Himmelfarb insists. Hitler murdered the Jews not because he had to, not because he was impelled by abstract historical forces toward an inevitable end, but because of his own personal will and desire. Because he wanted to, emphasis added. He wanted to. It's a bit surprising that Hitler's desire should have become so controversial, but in fact it is another one of the cruxes that has embroiled Hitler explainers, particularly in the last decade. Just how badly did Hitler want to proceed with the extermination, and just when, on what day, in what week, or what year, did he give an irrevocable signal to proceed with the final solution? The controversy over timing is more than a mere pettifogging squabble over days and weeks. Those who argue different decision dates for the final authorization are, in effect, proposing different Hitlers, differently motivated, possessed by altogether different priorities and substantially dissimilar mentalities. Here again, the tendency of contemporary scholarship has been to diminish Hitler as a motive force, to downplay his personal zeal for the slaughter, to portray him as a reluctant, indecisive, even dithering figure, inhibited by conflicting wartime priorities, perhaps even by timidity in the face of the enormity of the crime, as Christopher Browning suggested to me, from giving the final go-ahead. This recent tendency runs directly counter to the powerful argument elaborated by the late Lucy Davidovich in The War Against the Jews back in 1975, that Hitler had made mass murder his mission, his highest priority, as far back as November 1918 in an army hospital at Pozsavelk on the Western Front, where, in the throes of a still mysterious episode of, depending on whose account you believe, gas blindness, a nervous breakdown, hysterical blindness, a hallucinatory episode in which he heard voices, or a providential vision from on high, Hitler's version, he resolved to avenge the stab in the back he believed caused the German defeat by exterminating the Jews he held responsible. All of them. The controversy over the episode at Pozsavelk is itself a subset of a larger schism among Hitler's explainers over two distinct modes of explanation, evolution or metamorphosis. Is it possible to find in the thinly distributed, heatedly disputed facts of Hitler's life before he came to power some single transformative moment, some dramatic trauma, or some life-changing encounter with a Svengali-like figure? A moment of metamorphosis that made Hitler Hitler? It's a search impelled by the absence of a coherent and convincing evolutionary account of Hitler's psychological development, one that would explain his transformation from a shy, artistically-minded youth, the dispirited denizen of a Viennese homeless shelter, from the dutiful but determinedly obscure army corporal, to the figure who, not long after his return to Munich from the war, suddenly leapt onto the stage of history as a terrifyingly incendiary, spellbinding street orator. One who proceeded to take a party whose members numbered in the dozens and used it to seize power over a nation of millions, made that nation an instrument of his will, a will that convulsed the world and left 40 million corpses in its wake. Missing metaphorically, then, is something that will help us explain Hitler's baby pictures. Those baby pictures. If I had to choose a single defining moment in the course of researching and thinking about the search for Hitler, it might have to be that evening in Paris when I was on the receiving end of French filmmaker Claude Lanzmann's angry tirade over Hitler's baby pictures. When I witnessed the way the acclaimed director of Shoah, the 9.5-hour Holocaust documentary, metaphorically brandished the baby pictures, brandished the scandalizing idea of the baby pictures in my face as weapons in his personal, obsessive war against the question why. It was a moment that exposed both the passion behind the controversy over the problem of explaining Hitler and the question at its core. It might come as a surprise to many that the very notion of attempting to explain Hitler should seem not merely difficult in itself, but dangerous, forbidden, a transgression of near-biblical proportions to some. And in fact, Lonsman does represent an extreme position, the endpoint of a continuum, what I would call third-level despair over explaining Hitler. The point at which the despair turns to outright hostility to the process of explanation itself. The point at which the search for Hitler doubles back on the searchers. The depth and extremity of despair I encountered in the course of talking to Hitler explainers was one of the most surprising things I discovered in the process of writing this book. I began to get an intimation of what might be called first-level or evidentiary despair in some remarkable pronouncements by mandarins in the field, such as Alan Bullock and H.R. Trevor Roper. After 50 years, Trevor Roper avers, Adolf Hitler remains a frightening mystery. After 50 years, Alan Bullock could only say, The more I learn about Hitler, the harder I find it to explain. Jewish studies scholar Alvin Rosenfeld is even more definitive. No representation of Adolf Hitler has seemed able to present the man or satisfactorily explain him. But no one summed up the case for evidentiary despair more briskly and conclusively than Yehuda Bauer, a founder of the discipline of Holocaust studies and widely regarded as the most authoritative historian of the Holocaust. Hitler is not inexplicable, at least in theory, Bauer told me in his Hebrew University office in Jerusalem. It's not impossible to explain Hitler, but it might just be too late. Too late because too many crucial witnesses have died without giving testimony, because too many crucial documents have been destroyed, too many memories have faded, because all too many gaps in the evidentiary record will never be filled. Too many ambiguities can no longer be resolved. Hitler is not inexplicable, in theory, Bauer told me. But the fact that something is explicable in principle does not mean that it has been explained. It was in Jerusalem as well that I was initiated into second-level despair. Not evidentiary, but a deeper epistemological futility, by Emil Fackenheim, perhaps the foremost theologian of the Holocaust, as an essay and commentary characterized him. Fackenheim argued, contrary to Bauer, that Hitler is not explicable even in theory, that even if we had all the facts, Hitler was in some way beyond explanation, that no amount of biographical and psychological data about a difficult childhood, a dysfunctional family, no concatenation of trauma and deformation, no combination of bad character and evil ideology could add up to enough. Enough to explain the magnitude of Hitler's crimes. The systems of explanation, historical and psychological, that we employ to explain ordinary human behavior, however extreme, cannot explain Hitler, who represents, Fackenheim believes, a radical evil, an eruption of demonism into history, that places him beyond even the extreme end of the continuum of human nature. Fackenheim sees Hitler as more than just a very, very, very bad man, in the sense of ordinary human badness, but something else again entirely, something beyond that, the meaning of which we need to search for not in psychology, but in theology. The explanation for which, if there is one, can be known or fathomed only by God. But Claude Lonsman goes further even than that, goes deeper to a third-level despair, to a revolt against explanation itself, to a personal war against the question why. For Lonsman, the attempt to explain Hitler is not merely futile, but immoral. He calls the very enterprise of understanding obscene. There are some pictures of Hitler as a baby, too, aren't there? He has said. There is even a book written about Hitler's childhood, an attempt at explanation which is, for me, obscenity as such. Obscenity? I tried to explore with Lonsman the strength of conviction that would compel him to use obscenity as a term of abuse for investigators who, however misguided they might be, were at least well-intentioned. Why should the maker of a 9.5-hour documentary on Hitler's death camps become so incensed about a book on Hitler's childhood? What was it about the baby pictures? I sensed they disturbed, they scandalized him, not because they conjure up a specific theory of Hitler's childhood, but because they give us Hitler as an innocent. Hitler before he becomes Hitler. A Hitler without victims, as the phrase coined by the scholar Alvin Rosenfeld has it. A Hitler whose baby-faced innocence lures us down the path Lonsman condemns, seduces us into constructing explanations for the evolution of innocent child into mass murderer. Explanations that are, Lonsman argues, inevitably obscene rationalizations, not merely exculpations, but virtually justifications for Hitler's behavior. It's worth noting that when Lonsman tells us there are some pictures of Hitler as a baby, Hitler's baby picture has an interesting history as a pawn in the politics of Hitler's image-making, his stage-managing of his self-presentation. The baby picture appeared publicly first in a photo book published by Hitler's personal photographer, Heinrich Hoffmann, in 1932, a book disingenuously titled, The Hitler Nobody Knows. Despite the title's seductive intimation of confidences revealed, The Hitler Nobody Knows was in fact designed to counter the subcurrent of scurrilous speculations and gossip, the whispered Hitler apocrypha, the rumors fueled by Hitler's Austrian-born foreignness, by some indefinable alienness he radiated, a sense of strangeness and peculiarity, the vague impression of unwholesomeness he made on many Germans, a sense exacerbated by rumors about his private life, his confirmed bachelor status, and the well-known sexual scandals among his closest aides. Hoffman's book of photos was a bait-and-switch tactic, a strained attempt to make the point that the real hidden Hitler, the Hitler nobody knew, was, surprise, a paragon of family values normality, of wholesome German comradeliness. It was Hitler's own preferred Hitler explanation. In a sense, it could be said Hitler's strategy has succeeded. He remains a figure that, in some profound ways, nobody knows. The baby picture served a special purpose in this strategy. Along with the formal, somewhat mournful shots of his parents, it was designed, at least in part, to counter rumors that Hitler was illegitimate. It was not he, but his father who was. That there was some shameful mystery about his family origins, perhaps Jewish blood. The particular baby picture in question looks like it was taken when Hitler was less than 2 years old. In a snowy white Dr. Denton-type outfit, complete with white booties, we see a round-faced, ruddy-cheeked child, a mildly pensive cherub. We could, considering what we know of what became of him, backshadow, the useful term coined by the scholar Michael Andre Bernstein to characterize this dubious but hard-to-resist habit of thought, into his dark, questioning eyes, into those lips pursed into what looks like a pout or a frown, a premonitory, melancholy, even a haunted and hurt expression. We could project upon that impressionable baby face the stirrings of some deep emotional disturbance in embryo. But we could just as easily see there not incipient demonism, but a kind of gentleness and sensitivity. We could just as easily predict this child would turn out to be Albert Schweitzer. One can sense why Lonsman finds in the impressionable plasticity of the baby pictures a fatally alluring invitation, an invitation that lures the unwary into the seductive labyrinth of ratiocination, the deceptive and dangerous promise of understanding. Dangerous, perhaps, because at the heart of the labyrinth, the forbidden fruit on this particular tree of knowledge, lurks the logic of the aphorism, to understand all is to forgive all. Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origins of His Evil, by Ron Rosenbaum, Part 1.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.